Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Welcome to the latest episode of The Shamrock. I'm Pete Sampson, joined as always by Matt Fortuna. Today's special guest is John Walters, author of The Bubble Screen, an adjunct professor at Arizona State, former Sports Illustrated, NBC Sports, Newsweek, 1988 Notre Dame graduate, the guy you're most likely to try to set up with your single friends. We could talk about that too. John, thanks for making some time for us in Arizona. How are you doing? How is the offseason treating you?
I'm wonderful, Pete and Matt. And that's the best introduction I have ever gotten. I really appreciate that in every way. That was very good.
When we were trying to set this up, I said that I was going to have Kelly on the show with us. And you were like, oh, that'd be really interested if he could do that. I'm like, no, I meant my friend Kelly, who is single, that I've been trying to set you up with for a year. So that's sort of where my head is at.
But I wonder if your friend Kelly would say it's about recruiting. I mean, that would be, he's probably dealing with the same problem in her personal situation. It's about recruiting.
Could be. It's very difficult. It's a lot of Zoom conversations these days.
We've had so much success with our guests this year, as you've probably seen us tweet about endlessly. Aaron Taylor, the latest to get in the College Football Hall of Fame. If a couple met on the show and went on to have a long-lasting relationship together, I think that might take the cake.
That's far superior than Clark Lee getting the Vanderbilt job.
It might be. But I was laughing. I thought, you know, you should have never invited me. I'm breaking your string. All these people went on to a better job, and I thought, do they know who they're inviting on? Because if anyone can cool that string, it's me.
We've had nothing but colleagues as guests so far in 2021. So if you guys stay put, we'll be happy with that.
Well, John, I wanted to have you on because, like, you were here for the best of the Holtz era, sort of like the last romantic time in Notre Dame football. So to to speak about it more from a 30,000-foot view, because I do think there, you know, for Matt and I who weren't around for the Holtz era, Matt maybe even literally not around. He's young enough that perhaps he was.
Did you say 88? Yeah, nope. Yeah, wasn't even alive.
I'm curious, as this season wraps up, How do you sort of see Notre Dame football under Brian Kelly after 11 years, but also within the context of what is happening in Tuscaloosa, what's happening in Clemson, what's happening in Columbus?
I was thinking about this when you invited me on the show, and it fascinated me. I started to think about it. I'm like interviewing one of those D-Day veterans who can tell you like the storm of each anomaly. I was at the 1989 championship game. I was personally there as a student, not as a reporter, on January 2nd, 1989, the last day Notre Dame won a national championship. People are going to start interviewing me the way, especially 10 years from now, the way, you know, last remaining relic who witnessed it in person. So here's what I thought about, and people don't make enough about this. We watched Alabama school everybody, including Notre Dame, with players like Najee Harris and Devontae Smith, who's just spectacular. And, you know, having a guy like John Metchie and Brian Robinson is your afterthoughts, correct? Well, in 1988, Notre Dame, as much as their defense deserves the praise, Notre Dame had Tony Rice, most electrifying running quarterback of the day. They had Ricky Waters, a future NFL player. They had a freshman named Rocket Ismail, who did some pretty good things. Like, they had playmakers. Complete playmakers on that team. And it's not the only reason they won, but that's the difference. Like, no one else that they were playing that year. Miami had some playmakers, USC, you know, but Notre Dame was right there with everybody in terms of playmakers. And when Brian Kelly talks about recruiting, that's the difference at that level. they didn't have those guys. You had Javon McKinley, a fifth-year senior, you know, Ben Skowronek, a transfer from Northwestern, terrific players, but not in Devontae Smith's class. You know, I think Kieran Williams is a great, you know, addition, but he's not Najee Harris. So we're splitting hairs at the very top, but to me, that needs to be said about what Holtz's 1988 team had.
Where do you think Notre Dame goes from here? And I say that, you know, not to think it's all doom and gloom and everything. I mean, they're coming off their second playoff appearance in 3 years. And look, Brian Kelly, as much as a lot of people may take exception to his attitude in some of these moments, I mean, he's right. I mean, he has the same problem that even Ohio State, as we've seen the other night, has. So what do you think, to borrow a phrase from my co-host here, what do you think is the first next step for Brian Kelly and Notre Dame?
I think what you do is you just pepper Nick Saban with retirement brochures. The Florida Gulf Coast, you know, South Beach. Until Nick Saban leaves Tuscaloosa, no one is taking them off the mountain. And I love Nick Saban. I've really grown to love him as a coach over the last decade. I like his attitude. I like how he gets a little bit, you know, frustrated, but he's also trying to be nice. Like, I love everything about Nick Saban. But he is a superstar recruiter. He's a superstar detail attention payer. Alabama is not going anywhere. So if I'm Brian Kelly, like everyone else, I do my best to get as close as I can to Alabama. And, you know, I don't know what else you can do. Like, if you watched the first half of the national championship game, especially the first quarter and a half, Ohio State was doing Notre Dame in the 1992 Sugar Bowl, which, Matt, you were also too young to remember.
I was alive, but yeah.
So all Lou Holtz did, Florida had a superior playmaking talent. Lou Holtz just said, you can get to the red zone, and then we're going to hope that you make some mistakes. And that's what Ohio State was doing with Alabama, a clearly superior team. And it was 14-14. And when Mac Jones, if you remember watching, Kirk Herbstreit said they haven't gotten any pressure on Mac Jones tonight. On the very next, you know, seconds later, somebody blitzed, caused Mac Jones to fumble, and Ohio State scored. That's how you have to win games like that. It's like March Madness, one and done. You're going to need a few breaks. You're playing a clearly superior team. You don't have to win a best out of seven, but you're just going to need some breaks, and you have to do a bend, not break defense and make them do 12 and 11 play drives to score. I thought it was a brilliant philosophy. It didn't work out for four quarters, but I don't know how that's your best chance. Go back to the 1988 Miami Notre Dame Catholics versus Convicts game. Pat Terrell gets a first half pick six. Like, Miami was the better team. Everybody knows that. But Notre Dame was able to win one game with a fortuitous referee fumble call, Pat Terrell's pick six, and the rest just sort of worked in their favor.
Yeah, I sort of looked at the Alabama game for Notre Dame that way. It's like, not only were you going to need one non-offensive touchdown, you were probably going to need two, maybe even like a third created by a short field, which like Notre Dame really never came close to getting. And it was the only reason that Ohio State was in the game into the second half. You know, we've talked about Brian Kelly a bunch on this show. Obviously, John, you've come on and talked to us a little bit about him as well. But like, you know, you were there in the early days. You were in South Bend. I think you were still doing stuff with NBC way back then. I remember having some beers with you around, you know, that fall and sort of hashing out, like, is this guy going to make it here? Obviously, he has made it here. What has sort of impressed you from a distance about the way Brian Kelly has, I don't know, maybe reinvention is overstatement, but like, found his level here, found a way to like work within the structure of the university.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, like he never became Lou Holtz. He never wanted to become Lou Holtz. He knew he wasn't Lou Holtz. And by that, I mean, Lou Holtz came there and he embraced the culture of Notre Dame. He's going down to the Grotto for Mass and he, you know, spinning all the great yarns about Catholicism and his own, like, you know, grade school situation, and he became a folk hero. Brian Kelly was never going to be that guy, and he never auditioned for the part. And I think for that reason, there was a little coolness among the alums you know, like even just looking yesterday when Steve Sarkisian says we're going to sing the eyes of Texas. That's one of those moves where he's like, I'm with the old guard alums. Well, Ron Kelly was sort of like, you mean I have to do this alma mater thing? And I think he's a guy who's just like, this is a football job that gets me in the top eight every year in recruiting. That's how he looks at it. He doesn't look at it like it was my life's goal to be under the Golden Dome. And I'm fine with that as an alum. I mean, what he has brought to the school is a level of, and I'm using this word, I know it's a loaded word, he brought a level of professionalism to the program and the players. You don't see them doing stupid things. You don't see them getting dumb penalties. When's the last time Notre Dame fumbled twice in a game? They don't fumble. They just do the little things right, first of all. Second of all, he's gotten fans used to, like, great recruiting. Guys like Kyle Hamilton, like, that's just, like, that didn't happen at the end of the Charlie Weiss era. It never happened in the Tyrone Willingham era. Fans who don't have great sense of the perspective are going to say that Brian Kelly was never Leahy or Parsegian or Holt because he didn't win a national championship. Those guys would not win a national championship, maybe, playing in this era. The extra level of the playoff has made it impossible to sort of get your way through a decent schedule, win a few games in October, and then play a relative cupcake in January. I mean, remember, Notre Dame beat West Virginia for the national championship. They had already beaten USC and Miami, true. But this Notre Dame beat Clemson in November, and then had to go back and play Clemson again, and then had to play Alabama. That's not the way the world worked in 1988. So I'm fine with anyone who says that Brian Kelly belongs with those other names, because I think he does. And what he's done in 10 years from a football perspective is outstanding.
It's funny you say that. I got there in his second year, and between years two and three, and obviously there was a big difference in the quality of play in those years, I felt like I was witnessing a completely different coach, at least publicly. He seemed to be – he wasn't worshiping the Golden Dome, so to speak, but he was still trying to sell himself and sell everyone around this BCS vision, whereas he just kind of loosened up a little bit, laid back a little with a mature team in year three, and they end up having a great season. I just think he just wasn't in your face anymore. It's hard to explain, but I just feel like I was seeing a different guy from year two to year three. You kind of answered my question for me there, but where do you think with the passage of time, whenever he does hang it up, and you know, I hate to say assuming he doesn't win a national title, but assuming things keep going, let's say at the rate they are right now, how do you think he will be remembered among Notre Dame alums?
I don't know if there's a uniform legacy feeling among Notre Dame alums and fans. I remember we were debating Rick Riley Collins about Notre Dame's relevance when he took the job. No one's doing that anymore. It's amazing how quickly people forget where Notre Dame was when he took the job and where it is now. So it's fine if people want to be upset that Notre Dame isn't Clemson, Alabama, or Ohio State, but it's also not USC, Michigan, Texas, Nebraska, Penn State right now, who are all relevant programs, more relevant not too long ago. Like Notre Dame, and again, and I know I sound like an alum here, look at what other schools in the top 20 academically are anywhere near this conversation. What other schools with less than 20,000 enrollment are anywhere near this conversation? It's miraculous. How many other teams have Notre Dame's weather? You put those three things together, and I think Brian Kelly has done a fabulous job. It doesn't mean I love everything about him. I do love his evolution as an ambassador of the program. I think Muffin McGraw probably helped him a lot with that. Mike Gray probably helped him a lot with that. Two coaches who are high-profile Notre Dame coaches who have been there the entire time Brian Kelly has been there, and I think he has probably seen what they do and how they do it. It's probably rubbed off on him a little, but Pete and Matt, you guys are closer. You can speak to that better than I can. But, you know, those other guys have statues of them in front of the stadium. Brian Kelly's going to wind up with more wins and more 12-0 seasons than any of them ever had. So if you want to create a fifth statue and a fifth entry gate, be my guest.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
You know, I asked Brian Kelly about this, maybe in this, not this summer, it was the summer prior, about, you know, statues and legacy and all that stuff. And I the way I put it, it was like, basically, you know what the requirement is for a statue. That challenge isn't changing. But if you leave here without one, if you leave here without a national championship, but your name is on the Goog expansion, if that's the Kelly building for recovery or academic performance, is that something you're cool with? And I don't think he said exactly like, yeah, I'll take it. But I think there is there's a part of him now that has like extensive amount of skin in the game with Notre Dame, which I think is one of the interesting changes for him. And this is the question I asked him the day before the Alabama game, because he was talking about, somebody asked him about recruiting and there's challenges at Notre Dame and all that. And I think there's a couple ways you can look at challenges. One, you can bulldoze them out of the way, which I think was sort of his goal when he was hired. But the other way you can look at challenges is like, how do I make these work for me? Because they're not going away. I can't bulldoze them out. And I think that's where he is now at Notre Dame, which took a while to get there, but he's fully into it, where he looks at Notre Dame is going to do stuff a certain way. And I'm better off figuring out a way to maximize that than fighting it. It's like, you know, Nick Saban with hurry up offenses, like he can complain about it or he can change, he can evolve. And I think that's probably where Brian Kelly has evolved most.
Yeah. Adapt or die. I mean, after Lou Holtz, and again, like I was around for this, people seem to think that, hey, we put those gold helmets on and we're going to have an NBC contract. We're just going to win games. You need talent. You know, like Kyle Hamilton on your team makes a big difference. Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah makes a big difference. Notre Dame didn't have any of those guys on offense. And teams, you know, there was a great play in the Alabama game, second half. Ian Book goes back, gets flushed from the pocket. In almost any other game this year, he's running to his left. He gets 10 yards. He got caught from behind by the Alabama cornerback who had blitzed. You guys remember this play? He got caught like a creature on the Serengeti, like a leopard chasing down the antelope. And it was like, he said, people don't catch me. Well, yeah, Alabama catches you. And that's the difference, right? That play crystallized to me the difference between what Notre Dame can do in the regular season and the playoffs. You can get by the Georgia Tech, North Carolina defender when you're Ian Book. And we saw many plays like that in the North Carolina game. You don't get by Alabama's defenders doing that. So you have to have, to get to where people still want Notre Dame to get, you have to have those incredible players. That's it. Like the helmets don't mean anything. You know, touchdown Jesus don't mean anything. At that level, you got to have those players.
Pete brought this up in a mailbag, I think, last week. You know, if Kansas State finishes off Baylor in 2012, we're probably talking about another Notre Dame head coach who got his title in his year three. And the conversation obviously changes around Brian Kelly and Notre Dame then. But I don't mean to venture into hot take waters here. I don't think the program's in a better place right now in 2020 if it won a national title in 2012. I really don't. I mean, I just think that program
– I don't either.
As good as they were that year and as deserving as they were to be on that stage, there were still so many flaws and so many growing pains, if you will, that they still had to undergo and still were undergoing for the next 3 or 4 years. Not until really 2017 do I think we got to see the next level of Notre Dame under Brian Kelly. But I mean, if I told you, you were in the stands in 1988, like you said, if I told you then, and granted, you know, try not to see this through a student's eyes, but you said this is the last championship you'll ever see of Notre Dame in your lifetime. I mean, would you laugh at me? Would you say like, yeah, that's sport? I mean, knowing what you know now about, you know, life and the world and sports, I mean, how would you process that? Because I think to your earlier point, yeah, there is this glowing mystique around this program where they could kind of roll out and compete for championships every year. And especially now, that's just not the case.
Matt, as a native New Yorker that you are, I'm going to blow your mind here. I'm old enough, and this is why I fell in love with the sport. I remember the 1973 Knicks winning the NBA Finals, and I was like 5 years old, and I thought, this is the greatest thing. If someone had told me then that the Knicks are never going to win another NBA championship, I would have laughed in their face, right?
I thought you were going to say you were in the stands for Willis Reed when you were talking about being in the stands for Notre Dame's last championship.
No, not that close. But if you'll indulge me a second, the first NBA game I attended was the following season with 7 Hall of Famers starting. It was the Knicks versus the Bucks, who were starting Oscar Robertson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I wish I could go back and have like that game on my TikTok. That was the first game I ever went to. So the Knicks to me are a parallel to Notre Dame. Like, I would have never believed it. And what I'm trying to say in directly is that life peaked for me before the age of 22, but
we'll edit that out as I'm trying to fix you up with my friends, John.
I still agree if she ever meets me. Yeah. So so it's just like hard to believe, but yeah, times have changed. Like, again, Notre Dame got to play West Virginia. If they had beaten if they had beaten Boston College in 1993, they're playing Texas A&M for the national championship, which they played them anyway, but not for the national championship. So, yeah, that the playoff has created a different level of achievement. And also, like, as we're talking about this, think about if you're an Ohio State fan, you've got all the weapons at your disposal. You have better recruiting, easier admissions, more talent. And your team hasn't won a national championship since, what, 2015, 14?
Yep. Yep.
You've got to be a little bit chapped because you have everything there.
I mean, I watched the game on Monday night. I was like, this is a lot harder to rationalize if you're an Ohio State person than it was if you were a Notre Dame person.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you watch, like, it felt sincerely to me that Alabama deliberately took its foot off the gas in the second half of that Notre Dame Rose Bowl, quote unquote. I'm not sure why they did it. Maybe they didn't want to show Ohio State anything. Maybe there is a quality of mercy in Nick Saban. I don't know, but they definitely took their foot off the gas. So it's a 31-14 looks pretty respectable as next to 52-24. Matt, I would have been shocked. And I think when you see what Notre Dame did from 1989 to 1993, it's pretty hard to believe that they didn't win a second national championship with their record and with their talent.
How, as a Notre Dame fan and alum, how would you advise, I'm going to give you your soapbox here. Like, how would you advise Notre Dame fans to have a more healthy attitude about Notre Dame football and actually enjoy what they're watching?
Please do better than Brian Kelly did in his post-game press conference. Really high bar to clear here.
I don't know what he said. Can you give me a quick,
he told Notre Dame Nation to not jump off a roof.
Well, first of all, I would tell them to get off ND Nation. That would be my first, which in my house, I refer to it as indignation.
Yeah.
Cause that's sort of what it is. But you know, what would I'd tell my friends, like, you know, like the same thing I tell people about life: be appreciative, be appreciative. Like, just don't be an idiot. Like, you know, so maybe I'm being worse than Brian Kelly. Don't be an idiot. Like, you should be so appreciative of what you have here with this team and this school, and everybody wants to win the national championship. Duh. But like, I mean, you're just looking a gift horse in the mouth with what this team, how many home games did Ian Book lose? How many? Zero. You want better than that? You go to these games, you tailgate, you know, you go for that Saturday experience and the $600 hotel bill in South Bend. Like, you didn't get any losses in the last 3 years. Just shut up. So that would be my advice to Notre Dame fans and love and friends of mine who text. Like, just, you know, I've got my college friends and I still text, like 8 of us every day, and you know, we're all in our 50s, and it's the same thing. I say to them, just, and you know, shut up. And if we're gonna play Alabama, go fishing that day. Go for a hike. You know what's gonna happen.
Let's make sure one of our editors, who's a Notre Dame alum, listens to this podcast.
That would be great.
I do think I agree with everything you guys said, especially the Ohio State part. I mean, I'm trying not to put too much stock into an 8-game season, even though technically they could have won the national championship with those 8 games. I expected a lot more out of that roster and that coaching staff on Monday night, and that was really hard to rationalize. But I do think you mentioned all those programs earlier at the top of the show. Michigan, Texas, USC, Nebraska, Tennessee, all of them have had at least 3 coaching changes in the time since Brian Kelly took over.
And we didn't even mention Auburn. Auburn, put Auburn in there.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, they would have had 2 now, right? Chizik, Malzahn, and Brian Harsin now. Yeah. Miami. They did win a national title in 2010. I look at that as a strength for Notre Dame, obviously, stability wise. I also look at it as, eventually one of these teams, or probably multiple of these teams, are going to figure it out, right? Like, you know, as much as we like to hang our heads on Notre Dame not winning a national championship, Michigan, Texas, USC, somebody's going to figure it out amongst that blue blood group that hasn't figured it out in a while. I don't know if it's going to be Steve Sarkisian or whomever, but eventually like this field, Florida, you know, this field will get more crowded. How do you think Brian Kelly and Notre Dame guard against that without, you know, trying to think too far down the road here? I mean, you know, they can't just roll out the balls and get to the playoff again next year, especially with everything they're losing from this roster. But the long-term program building wise, how do you think they not only try to catch up to Alabama, but also fend off all the other people who are trying to catch up to them?
Well, Notre Dame did a very monumental thing this season that I'm not sure if any of those other schools have done lately. I don't have it off the top of my head. Notre Dame beat a number one team. And that's something you can no longer curse Brian Kelly with. So from a recruiting standpoint, from an image standpoint, that's a big deal, I think, going forward. They checked that box. And you can make all the Trevor Lawrence, you know, Skalski points that you want to make, granted. But that is going to help them going forward with recruiting, with the idea that, like, no, they haven't plateaued. They can do more. Obviously, Marcus Freeman, who we haven't even mentioned, you know, on this podcast, is going to help as the new defensive coordinator. So everything always is in flux, right? Like, some of the schools you mentioned are going to get better. There's a chance that, like, maybe Clemson or Ohio State may have peaked for a short bit. Who knows? I don't see Alabama going anywhere, which is, again, like, that's the beauty of Nick Saban, the consistency. But if you're Brian Kelly, like, you just have to, you know, find a way to get great players and get them on the field. Like, I can't wait till Jordan Johnson and Braden Lindsay emerge from the witness protection program and Pete tells me where they were all season.
Traits.
Like, that's going to be
traits,
wonderful.
John, traits. Yeah.
So, like, you know, that's the thing. But again, like, that game, that televised game in prime time, beating Clemson was, I think, the biggest thing Brian Kelly did for the future of this program over the next few years.
Yeah, I would agree that it was a pretty big box to check. And it's like, in your recruiting brochures or your recruiting pitches, when you're showing the field being stormed, you know, mm-hmm. there's no like lower third graphic that says, Trevor Lawrence was out with COVID. Like that's that
right.
Notre Dame can sell that moment with no asterisks, nothing to be taken away from it. And that's a big, big deal. Cause it wasn't that long ago that, you know, when they lost to Georgia in 2017, I mean, that was sort of one of the first steps in like the rebuilding to where Notre Dame is right now. Like a recruit was at the game and his parents asked Brian Kelly, like, why should I send my kid here when this stadium gets taken over by Georgia fans? Like that was a really bad right. look for Notre Dame. It sort of evolved out of that. And I think Clemson was a really appreciable step forward. Obviously Clemson part two was bad and Alabama was what it was, but yeah, I think that's a big step forward.
Yeah. You've got to be able to, we're all curious to see what Tyler Buckner is going to do. I'm not sure if it's this year really to think, worry about that, but you know, in the future, and who he brings in, it's funny. Like we were talking, you're talking about team programs up on the rise. Remember when Stanford, not very long ago, was one of those teams we'd be mentioning, and how did they do it? They did it with intellectual brutality? Was that team?
That's right. That sounds so long ago, but yeah.
Intellectual brutality and 6'7" tight ends and wide receivers disguised as tight ends. Like Notre Dame can do that. Like they can get these great tight ends, this imposing offensive line. And again, like they can win 10 games a year. And with that, because they can get the elite guys at those levels. If you want to win the national championship, you need to find Rocket Ismail. I mean, again, you need Ricky Waters. I didn't even mention Tony Brooks was a running back on that team. And Mark Green was actually the starter who didn't have the talent those guys did, but he was a senior. So that's the level of separation. All American playmakers that puts you in a different class. I mean, I don't think Ohio State wins on Monday night, but Trey Sermon in the game, the whole game makes it a different game. They lost him on the first play. So there's a few special guys every season, and that's usually the separation point between teams with great offensive lines and great defensive lines. And as you guys probably know, if you look just 20 years ago, which is a long time, but 20 years ago, teams with the best total defenses or scoring defenses were winning the national championship every year. This year, in the last couple of years, it's been teams with the best offenses. The game has completely changed. You win a national championship giving up 24 points and it's a blowout. Like that didn't happen in the old days. You held a team to 10 points or something. So it's just, you've got to have those guys.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You write the bubble screen, so we have to address this topic while we have you. The title game had arguably two of the three biggest brands of the sport. And only had 18.7 million viewers, the lowest for a title game since Oklahoma-USC to cap, I believe, the 2004 season. Look, it's a weird time in this country. I'm not pointing fingers at anyone. I mean, I think this is in some ways very emblematic of what's happening with ratings in every other sport at this level, at the championship level. But what do you think is the problem here, and how do you think it gets addressed? Or is it as simple as, hey, things will one day get back to normal, and that's that?
I don't think things will one day get to back to normal in terms of the viewership ratings. My personally, and you guys can tell me what you think, my biggest takeaway from that is after New Year's Day, we're all over it. I am. Like, I can't wait for New Year's Day. And maybe it's my age because I remember growing up on New Year's Day. New Year's Day is gigantic. I'm all in on college football. Then they make us wait a week or longer. And I just don't care. Like, I've moved on. And these were two great programs. I don't know if you could have found a game that the matchup was so sexy that people's interest would last 8 days. But the Super Bowl, in contrast, benefits by it being there's not much else going on in late January and early February. It's cold in the populated places in the Northeast and Midwest. The NBA is in the doldrums. College basketball is just in the middle of its season. The Super Bowl has the platform all to itself, and it's a bigger deal. Like, I find that they made a huge mistake in assessment, thinking that they could have all this stuff go on in New Year's and that people would still be as engaged 7 to 8 days later. Because frankly, I'm not. I don't know how you guys feel, but that to me is their biggest problem.
Yeah, I agree to a certain extent. And by that, I mean, I can easily see how every non-Alabama, non-Ohio State fan lost interest over the last week or so and wasn't geared up for this game. But I thought, and I know this is a crazy year, so circumstances are different. Last year, there were 16 days between the semis. And like today's January 13th, a year ago today, LSU played Clemson. And I thought that would be a complete bomb for ratings because mm-hmm. it's a 16-day separation. Clemson, as good as they've been, doesn't have the national following that Ohio State or Notre Dame does. And they had 25.5 million. I think that was one of the best title games ever. I don't know if it's as simple as having new blood in there with LSU and playing in New Orleans and so forth, but I agree with your line of thinking. It didn't really add up last year. And so I'm just curious if there's something else going on.
Yeah. I think there might be other things going on in the world right now.
But
I do think that sort of depresses the interest in that. Like, you're so exhausted from everything else. It's hard to be like, oh yeah. And then there's this game that I really want to watch.
We had two podcasts about Notre Dame last week about their offseason. Yeah. Even though the college football offseason technically didn't start yet.
Well, there were a lot of actual good things that came out of this season, things that couldn't be planned, things that had to be put into action because of the unique circumstances that I hope or wish the college football would carry forward. One thing I would love to see them do is extend the regular season. I can't believe I ever hear myself saying this. If you could extend the regular season, here's a few benefits. First, teams would get two bye weeks during the season, which I think would help everybody, the players particularly, in terms of resting up and healing. Second, there is less time for the superpowers to plan between these games, which I think evens the game up a little bit. You give Alabama 16 days to plan, it's ridiculous. Like, I don't think we need that much time. It doesn't benefit fan interest. It doesn't benefit like the closeness of games. Like, a smaller window between these conference championship games and the bowls, I believe, is very beneficial. And also, like, why do we need to like end the regular season December 4th or 5th and then do the banquet circuit and just wait? Like, this year's show, there's no reason to do that. So I would love to see them extend the regular season out, get a week or two more of Saturdays, give teams in the middle two Saturdays off, not just one. And everything, I think, benefits from that.
I'm with you. I felt like January 1 is the big day, and then it almost felt like the national championship game was a coda to the season, which is not what you're going for with the playoff.
Right.
It was almost like you need to figure out a way to re-engineer the calendar where the national championship game is on the first, which would require like the playoffs being in, mid December. And maybe that's, if you go to an 8-team playoff, maybe you play, January 1 for the championship game and sort of backdated a week to the semis and backdated a week to the quarters, and have them be on campuses to give you a little bit more of a college football vibe opposed to like, NFL light, which is kind of what all these things feel sometimes. So I don't know. I think that we in the media are a little too quick to go with like 1 year as a trend. But the viewership number is like, God, that was bizarre. You got to at least sort of acknowledge that and think about what might fix it.
And you have to like stop having one foot in the past and one foot in the future, the present. For example, if you're still going to have bowl games, the way we have the current system, then stop telling me we need to have this conference affiliation with this bowl and this conference affiliation with this bowl. We want the best matchups, and ESPN controls the bowls. So get in a room with Jimmy Pitaro and the heads of conferences and tell him, listen, Georgia-Cincinnati is a sexy game. Make that game happen.
you know, USC versus Florida is a sexy game. Make that game happen. Don't tell me they can't play in this bowl because their conference is affiliated with this bowl. It's archaic. It's just, it's stupid. Like, you figure out the best matchups, and if the bowls still want to be involved, they need to go along with it, because no one cares anymore that the Big 12 has been affiliated with this bowl for this many years. It's about getting viewers to watch. And again, speaking from my own perspective, it's the games that I want to see with the matchups I want to see. So I'm trying to remember, like, who did Iowa State destroy in the bowl game? Or just
Oregon.
Was it Oregon? That was a pretty interesting matchup. Like, you know, like, they don't play each other. They don't see each other. To me, like, that was an interesting matchup. Obviously, like, Georgia-Cincinnati got great ratings. Exactly. Like, so stop being, like, so stubborn when you need matchups that matter.
I think that sounds great in theory. I think we have 151 years of evidence that says the sport does not care at all what fans think or want. The Bulls control the circuit. They host in non-COVID times banquets and golf outings.
But they won't anymore. That's, you know, the whole point. There's no reason for Bulls to be powerful anymore. ESPN is the power. TV ratings are the power. The conference commissioners know that's where my money comes from, is ratings. And ESPN controls the sport. So you these guys in these blazers, we're just mollifying them. We're humoring them. There's no reason to do so. The minute, like, ESPN and the commissioners could wake up tomorrow and tell these guys, you guys are out of the picture. Like, we don't need to be paying you off anymore. You don't mean anything to us anymore. Like, you may mean something to our viewers' grandparents and parents, but you don't mean anything to us. If you still want to be involved, do it this way. What are they going to do? They've got no power.
I agree. I mean, I think it's going to take a while to get to that point. And I think, you know, as we see conference commissioners, you know, the real power players turn over here with the Big Ten and the ACC in the last 2 years, and we'll see it throughout other leagues in the coming years. That will be kind of the first next step to undoing the system and the structure the way it is. My fear would be with your scenario is, if it becomes about ratings and it becomes about sexy matchups, my fear is we're going to get even less opportunities for a Coastal Carolina or a Liberty to not play each other again, right? To play a heavyweight, to see one of these group of five teams that goes undefeated or loses one game get a chance against a Power Five. Like, I could see that having a backfiring effect on the non-Power Five schools, if you will.
I have to think about that a little more. I think that, you know, as sports writers and Twitter, and again, we sometimes live in our own echo chamber. I understand
sometimes.
That, but like, Coastal Carolina was a great story and fans got interested, and the BYU Coastal Carolina game was one of the games of the year. Fans got interested. Can I give you a quick personal Sports Illustrated vignette that will illustrate my point?
Go ahead.
If you don't mind. All right. With the word illustrate twice. It was in the early 2000s, and a prominent Sports Illustrated senior writer, who you know but I won't name, came in to complain to a man who is now a very high-ranking figure at The Athletic about the fact that his story was not showing up on the web the way he wanted it to after it appeared in the magazine. And the second man said to the first man, he pointed to the computer, and he said, "This is what controls print now." I don't know if I have it verbatim, but he's basically telling him, it's the computer, stupid. It's not the magazine anymore. We have taken over. This is what matters. The internet matters. Your old, you know, my SI is arriving in the mail on Thursday anymore. That is a vestige. And again, like, that's what the Bulls are now. The Bulls are a vestige whose power is only illusory, and it's going to end before you know it, just the way Sports Illustrated is no longer a weekly, which, if you would have told me that in 1988, I would have told you were crazy. So, like, it's the power of the Bulls is just vestigial. The ratings matter, and fans, you know, you can't control what fans are interested in. Like, the magic of Cincinnati and Coastal Carolina came out no matter what anybody tried to do about it, because fans love an underdog. Fans love undefeated teams. So, to me, the biggest need
one of the biggest needs is to create matchups so that, gosh, you guys are really giving me a soapbox today, by the way. Thank you. but here's another stupid thing I hear every year. Well, if we don't play those division, those FCS schools, well, they may not have a football program. Oh, suddenly you're a philanthropic football program? Give me a break. You're playing those teams for a bye week where you still get people in the stadium. If you compel teams to no longer be able to play FCS teams and tell them, like, you've got to get sexy matchups all of your games, we'll have a better sport. We'll have better television ratings. And yes, you may have an extra loss, but if everyone's going through this, then it's fine. Like, there should, I see these fans who want more conference games and then a couple of SCS games. That's exactly the opposite of what you should be doing. You should have eight maximum conference games, eight, and then the other four games need to be interconference matchups. And here's a crazy thought. Your school doesn't get to pick who you play. Someone else does. like, why do we take it for granted that, like, Alabama gets to schedule who it plays out of conference? That doesn't happen in the NBA. That doesn't happen in the NFL. Stop that immediately, and you have a better sport.
How's that happen, though? There's not even – they could even agree whether to play or not play this year. There's no commissioner.
Okay, but that's what you need to have. You need to have – it doesn't have to be a one-person commissioner. Like, you have to tell, like, these guys, you show them the ratings in that game, and you tell them, you're in trouble, and we're getting to you before, like, the earth turns 137 degrees every day. Like, here's the way to improve your sport before it's too late. Like, we fans love it when Michigan plays at Washington. Fans love it when Ohio State plays at Oregon. And the only reason you're not doing these games is because you're afraid you're going to get an L and you're not going to make it to the national championship. Well, everyone has to buy in. Everyone who wants to play for the national championship has to agree no more FCS teams and agree that we will play four non-conference games, two at home, two on the road, and someone else determines that, not us. Do that tomorrow and you have way more fan interest.
I like it. I like where this is going. I think this is a good note to end this podcast on, the complete destruction of the college football scheduling model. It would be better in the end.
As entrepreneurs will tell you, and if you serve the customer, everything else will follow. If all you worry about is making a profit and you don't serve the customer, your business will soon fail.
If John Walters goes on to become the first commissioner of college football after this podcast, then I think our work here would be done.
Goodness.
Like that would be that'd be even better than like meeting someone on Zoom and getting married. Like, that'd be great.
Now that would be quite the job upgrade.
Yes.
Talking about your other guests. So
as guys, long as you don't big time us after
never,
you take a job.
You know that. You know, I would never big time you guys. But thanks for having me on. And again, thanks for letting me vent. This is all just inside and you brought it out.
Yeah, this is why this show is superior to the Audible. Bruce and Stu keep cutting you off all the time. So, all right. He's John Walters, a man of many talents. That if you have single friends, you're listening to the show, reach out. We'll try to make a connection. Matt Fortuna. As always, I'm Pete Sampson. Thanks for being with us on the latest episode of The Shamrock.